Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. When I want to hear the bottom line in terms of practice implications of clinical research data, I go to Dr. John Marshall, an oncologic cowboy who shoots from the hip and tells it like it is. When John first walked into the room for our most recent interview at the ASCO GI meeting in Orlando, I immediately observed a new appearance to his demeanor. Still the same whimsical professor, John looked haggard, stressed, and fatigued, and as we sat down, he confessed that in the last few months, his life and perspective on cancer medicine has changed remarkably. But more of that later, as we begin with some of the key questions he receives from practicing oncologists about management of patients with colorectal cancer.
There's a big struggle right now as to what's frontline therapy. We're starting to see some swing back away from heavy oxaliplatin to more irinotecan incorporation frontline. Not tons, though. It is still mostly a FOLFOX world in metastatic disease with colon cancer. In that regard, we're seeing more and more Xelox. There's more data to support using Xeloda instead of infusion 5-FU. The schedule and the toxicity and all that needs to be ironed out still, but we are seeing that. Probably the biggest unknown out there that I think is a major medical and economic impact is the role of continuing Avastin beyond initial progression. And we just unfortunately don't have the answer to that. The scientists in us tell us that it's a good idea. The economists in us tell us we shouldn't be doing it. And we really need to figure that out.
How are you approaching the use of Avastin in clinical practice? First of all, in terms of the patient who starts to develop problems with the chemotherapy, particularly neurotoxicity, and then at the second point, which is at progression, what do you do outside of a protocol?
I tend to believe in the Optimox type strategy, and I do, whether I'm using Optimiri or Optimox, after I get my optimum response, which is usually around 4 months of therapy, I begin to back off. And for the most part, when I back off, I maintain some flavor of 5-FU and usually maintain Avastin. I often switch to an every 3-week schedule, bump the dose accordingly, and watch people. Again, not knowing that's right or wrong, but it's what I do. I think the recent Optimox 2 data gives us complete permission to not do anything in that window. So you can stop treatment altogether. As a clinical trialist, I think that's the ideal opportunity to bring new medicines in. So we are beginning to design more and more trials to test new medicines in that window to see if, in fact, we can use them to stabilize or prolong progression. When patients then reprogress, if you will, on that regimen, for the most part, I will change to the other base chemo. I know a lot of folks like to resume the old one. If they were on ox, bring back the ox. If they were on iri, bring back the iri. But frankly, I sort of save it for down the road and then go to the other one, whichever one it was.
Now, when you do that, do you continue the Bev or stop it?
Well, a little bit depends on what else I'm doing. I've done both. Often, though, at that point, I'm bringing in an EGFR blocker, even though that's not what the rules say we should be doing. If I'm going irinotecan second line, you know, at least in our practice, we commonly incorporate an EGFR blocker at that point. And I think more recent trials are supporting that practice, that you don't have to wait to CPT-11 refractory in order to bring in an EGFR blocker. In fact, the data with EGFR blockers now are such that pretty much every place they've been tested, they've shown to have some positive impact. Last line, second line, and now some first line data. Adjuvant's still out there.
So when you make this decision in terms of the patient who's progressing, do you factor in how they responded to the treatment? So if the patient had a great response and it goes on a longer time, does that change what you might do?
Yeah, I think if they progress rapidly or don't respond as much, I'm less enthusiastic about keeping that drug on board, and therefore I'll switch it up a bit. But if, like you say, if they've had a very nice benefit from it, we sort of don't want to give that up. I think there are a lot of patients out there with Avastin that you recognize we're changing the biology of these tumors. They just slow down. And it's not necessarily that they further respond. You just kind of turned them off. I really hesitate to pull that drug off of there. I describe it to my patients even. I said, well, if your tumor's level, and I hold my hand up level, said versus, you know, a little bit of progression, that's still okay. But if I let go, it might grow at this pace. And so I think clinically that's what we're seeing too, is this quieting of colon cancer, and you get these long-term survivors with metastatic disease.
You talked about the issue of cetuximab and going to cetuximab. Where is panitumumab fitting in for you right now?
Yeah, I was going to say the second most common question I'm getting right now is, all right, so I've given cetuximab, should I now give panitumumab? My answer to that right now has been no. Now, I have to say that I'm beginning to get a little bit more experience in this patient population. Now, again, I guess on the record but off the label, is I do a lot of BOND to last line regimens. In fact, I go as far as saying I really don't want to let people die without combining EGF and VEGF at some point. Recognizing that BOND 2 was in naive patients, clinically, you know, I'm seeing and others are seeing really fairly consistent activity, even in the non-naive, in the previously exposed patient, when you put the two antibodies together.
And you're using cetuximab, I assume.
I have been, obviously. So now, you know, I've got patients who would like to have the week off.
Right.
And so they come into me and saying, well, can I switch up and go to panitumumab? And I say, sure. So what's interesting is that when I do that, I am seeing a little bit more renewed activity. I'm also seeing a renewed rash. So a lot of patients who've kind of quieted down with their cetuximab rash, I'm now putting in panitumumab instead and seeing a little bit more rash and often a little bit more activity. So my initial response to that question of if they've had cetuximab, should I get panitumumab, was no. I'm now wondering a bit, are they actually in some way subtly different? The other possibility to what I'm seeing so far is that, you know, a patient who's been on Erbitux a long time, I often give them a week off here and there. And that's kind of like lightening up the chemotherapy or the treatment. And when you go to the panitumumab, there really isn't a lightening up. The every 2 week dose is back to full Monty, if you will. So maybe all I'm doing is just redialing up the EGFR blockade and giving it for longer.
Any other situations where you're using panitumumab, period? What about in patients who haven't had cetuximab?
Yeah, no, we've incorporated it as an initial treatment of choice for patients in a refractory setting.
By itself or with
no,
chemo?
No, I really don't think these drugs work best by themselves. I mean, they work. They're single-agent activity. It hasn't taken much for me to combine them with chemotherapy.
So you're saying in a patient who hasn't had cetuximab, you're going to start anti-EGF agent and you're going to go with panitumumab and
either
chemo?
Either one. I think there are choices there, but I would feel comfortable combining either one with irinotecan. I have done it with either one.
What's been your observation, and not just your own personal observation, but in terms of what you're reading and hearing in terms of infusion reactions? I found it a little confusing as I listened to people talk about this with cetuximab versus panitumumab.
Yeah, I don't want to jinx myself, but we haven't had a cetuximab infusion reaction in a while. There's an interesting paper about not needing to use Benadryl or pre-medication with Erbitux for most patients. But I, you know,
what do you
we
think
do
about
see
that paper, incidentally?
Well, I think Len and his group have done a very nice job of improving patients' quality of life. They've shortened the Avastin infusions. They're shortening other infusions. So I'm delighted that they're improving the pace at which we can treat patients up in the clinic. As now a consumer of chemotherapy, it's, you know, that extra half an hour matters, that not needing Benadryl matters. But anyway, back to your question about infusion reaction, I would probably say I have 10 times more experience with Erbitux cetuximab than I do with panitumumab. So from my own personal experience, I haven't seen really infusion reactions yet for panitumumab, but I'm not expecting to.
What are some of the other questions you get from oncologists in practice?
I think there is still a fair bit of recipe treatment going on, and I forgive oncologists for that because if they have to take care of all the different cancers, it's impossible to not have to follow some basic recipes. So I think one of the main reasons they come out for a talk or give us a call is the style stuff, and how would you dose it, how would you modify this? Good responses. How do I keep it that way? I get a lot of calls like that. Should I push this patient to the OR? You know, is this a resectable patient? What do you think? And they're basically just asking opinion and style points. They know their oncology very well. They just want to make sure their patients are having the best angles on things.
In terms of metastatic disease, one of the things that seems to be happening fairly quickly over the last few years is orientation towards looking for curable oligometastatic disease. Can you talk about your own approach in that regard?
I think the approach to treating patients with metastatic disease that you think might be curable really depends on the hand that you're dealt. It depends on how many metastases. Is the primary in place or not? The location of those metastases, do they need to be downstaged or not? But in general, I would say I am adopting more and more a chemo-first approach. In my opinion, patients who are going to benefit the most from a surgical approach, a resection of a metastatic lesion, are those who've responded to chemotherapy. There's good data to support that. And in fact, you know pretty well that they're not going to die of the two or three mets you're looking at right now. They're going to die of the next 10 that show up. So the marker, if you will, of a responding metastatic lesion to me is quite encouraging and powerful. When our response rates are quite high, so more and more patients are being offered surgery for oligometastatic disease, we're now having sort of an opposite problem. It's a good problem, but I'm taking care of a young man right now who has a rectal tumor, two liver metastases, actually is on a Xeloda trial, and after two rounds of Xelox plus Avastin has had such a good response that we can barely now see his two liver metastases. And he's had a nice response in his rectum. So what I want to do is I don't want to get too cute. I got a rectal lesion we got to fix. I got two liver lesions that I think we're going to be able to fix. Surgeons like to do those two operations separately. They don't like to do big liver resections and rectal resections in the same procedure. So we got to time that. And if I keep going too much more with chemotherapy, I'm not going to be able to find the lesions to resect. Not that I think chemo cured them, but they're now not detectable. So what a good problem to have, but having to sort of dance that dance and make sure we don't mismanage his rectal area and make sure we still have him a shot for the liver resection is where we are. So frankly, our decision is after four cycles, we're going to restage him again, then pause and do radiation, so now neoadjuvant radiation, and maintain some Xeloda and probably some oxaliplatin during that radiation. Restage after that, and then probably do a rectal resection, and at the same time, instead of a lobe, do RFA on the residual tumors, and that they can do at the same sitting.
What do we know about what's seen histologically in people who have clinical CRs in the liver?
We know that a lot of these people still have residual disease, but quite honestly, some don't.
So how do you decide whether or not to resect the area?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I actually, on this particular patient, called the surgeon and said, well, what would you do if you got in there and you couldn't see it? Well, he knows anatomically where they were, so he can resect the region that they were in. It's also important to note that even though our traditional imaging shows nothing, they get in there in an ultrasound and can find areas. So that's why I got a little nervous in this guy, that his response was so good that we then wouldn't be able to do what we hope would be a curative resection on his liver.
Interesting. Where are we right now in terms of intrahepatic use of chemotherapy? The NSABP has that as one of their studies that they're looking at. Not accruing too well, not too much interest in that whole field. Where do you think it's going?
I think we want it to work because it makes sense to us and because it's such a common location for recurrent disease. But we just haven't been able to prove that it does. And it is a hassle, and patients don't like it. And it does require specialized centers that do it a lot to really get the best results. So in my opinion, it's still not something to be used as a standard. I can't fault anybody for trying it and incorporating it, and I encourage people to participate in the trial. But for right now, it's certainly not widespread use.
So in clinical practice, then, you're selective about what you do in this situation.
Right. I make a judgment based on the patient in front of me. But if an Erbitux or a panitumumab were to play well in the frontline therapy, let's say we got good response rates out of those, you might see a further shift towards leaving primaries in situ and using that sort of biologic combination as frontline therapy, because there you have fewer worries about the bleeding and perf complications.
That's interesting. Is that another concern that you have in terms of that maybe the patient's going to need emergency surgery and they got Bev on board?
Sure. If the drugs fail and they were, let's say, near obstructing, and now you got to operate on them, while the surgeons will tell you it's okay, I think we know that there's a higher complication rate in that patient.
Interesting. What about adjuvant therapy? What are you hearing there?
I think we need to continue to move the bar. I think the standard right now is FOLFOX therapy. I think that's one of the first times ever we've got a global standard, quite honestly. I think you get almost anywhere in the world right now. For stage three patients, that'll be recommended. I think the incorporation of the biologics is certainly interesting. I still don't understand why irinotecan doesn't work in the adjuvant setting.
Are you convinced it doesn't?
No, but it's not something I readily put in play in an adjuvant setting. I'd need some extensive extenuating circumstances in order to do that. I do believe there are some subsets that will benefit from irinotecan. We just haven't figured out who they are. But nonetheless, I think the current trial that we're accruing to is the FOLFOX plus minus Erbitux clinical trial. And it's interesting how quickly the Avastin trial accrued and how relatively slower this one is accruing. And it comes right back to the point of rash. It's a side effect that patients really dodge. You can talk to them about heart attacks and strokes and bleeding and hypertension, but you talk to them about not life-threatening but disfiguring rash, and all of a sudden they're like, I don't know if I want to do that. And it's really an interesting phenomenon.
It is interesting because it's a little counterintuitive that they would say that before they got it. I could see once they got the rash that maybe it'd be worse than what they thought it would be. But you're saying right up front they have problems with it.
Well, we're describing it to them. I mean, we have to be fair. And they say, well, what's the risk of this new drug? And, you know, we have pictures of folks, and they're sitting in lobbies with people that have it.
Right.
If you think about my clinic on a Tuesday morning, there are 20 people out there because I'm always running behind. You know, 10 of them have rash, and so they know what we're talking about.
Interesting. What about stage 2 disease? I'm sure you get a lot of questions about that. What's your approach to it?
Well, again, I think on the one side, it's clear that we're dramatically over-treating patients. We're giving chemotherapy to 100 folks to help what may be 3 to 6 people in the long run. I'm fundamentally not against that. I just would like to figure out who the 20 or 30 are that could benefit and give them chemotherapy. So we try to accrue to the clinical trial that sorts patients according to their genetic markers, and we've had some luck at that. For the most part, patients are still interested in pursuing chemotherapy. I think you've shown better than anybody that patients with education, whether it's fair education or not, will opt for it. And the subject of your presentation here. And I think it's a touchy subject, but still something that we are doing with some regularity. I think docs in the community are probably, well, I don't know, but my feel is that they're treating more of these people than they were before. They're using a lot more Xeloda in this patient population. But we're also seeing patients, you know, because of maybe the lymph nodes, there weren't so many lymph nodes. We've clearly got that message out that are getting more chemotherapy, looking again for an excuse to give chemotherapy.
So you're saying that, you know, in the lower risk patient, some docs are going for using just Xeloda alone as kind of, well, I want to do something. Yeah. I don't want to really make you sick.
Which doesn't make sense to me. I mean, if you're going to do it, do it. The data would say that FOLFOX would pick up a couple of more people than Xeloda by itself. And I've heard Amory de Grammont say this, and frankly, I agree with him. I'd rather have 3 months of FOLFOX than 6 months of Xeloda if I'm a stage 2 patient.
What about using CAPOX, basically?
Yeah, I had a patient just Friday asking that same question. It's tough for me. I answer it just this way. I tell patients that it probably is fine. That the data with Xeloda is positive, the data with oxaliplatin, whether it's infusion or bolus, is positive, so it probably is fine. And then I put my little asterisks on it and say, but I've been wrong before. I used to think, why not give irinotecan in the adjuvant setting, and did that off protocol in advance of data. And frankly, I also think that the Xelox regimen is more toxic than a FOLFOX regimen when given with sort of non-fiddle doses in a U.S. market. So for all those reasons, I sort of presented it as the hassles of a pump versus the higher toxicity and convenience of a pill. To me, that's how it comes down. Would I do it? Yeah. Would I like doing it? No, not without data. But if somebody said, no way, I'm not having a pump, I then try and steer them towards the NSCBP data and bolus, because at least we have some data there. But we still settle out and give some patients Xelox.
So I was just thinking, you know, you're the first person I ever interviewed for this series many years ago. I remember thinking, God, I have no idea what I'm talking about here. And you kind of, you know, I don't know if you realize how naive I was at that point about this, but you really kind of pushed me in the right direction in terms of trying to understand all the stuff that's happening here. And one thing that we've demonstrated from our patterns of care studies is that clearly the bar to treat the lower risk patient is much lower in breast cancer than it is in colon cancer. And of course, the database is much stronger in breast cancer. What are your thoughts about that dichotomy that we see in practice?
On one hand, I get it totally. You've got trials in breasts that were powered to show it. And when you have that, you sort of feel an obligation to give it. And you've got a much stronger advocacy group, if you will, demanding that therapy. So it's a match made in heaven. on the GI cancer side, whether it's our own inertia, whether it's not having drugs to play with, I'm not sure, or whether it's all of a sudden having too many drugs, if you will, to play with. But we haven't really decided that treating that patient population as a whole is worth it, and we don't have the data sets as strong to support doing it. And we're also sort of, for the first time in GI cancer, confronting drugs with cumulative toxicities. You know, you could give 5-FU forever, but now we have a drug, particularly in the adjuvant setting, where if you give 12 full cycles of FOLFOX, you got a relatively neurotoxed patient at the end of that treatment. So I think we struggle, quite honestly. I'm proud of us for having done the sort of genetic sorting study, you know, or doing that study, because that's really where we should be using our energies, is trying to sort the patients in advance of giving them chemotherapy. You know, again, if I knew in my own house that I didn't need to be taking chemotherapy, I'd be delighted to not be going through what we're going through. On the other hand, if I knew we were in that bad group, I'd put up with a lot. So to me, that is one of the most important things in adjuvant, is being able to sort that. So in that sense, I'm proud of the GI group for having figured some of this out. It takes too long to answer some of these questions. That's another frustration. It takes us longer to accrue these trials in colon than it does in breast, even though we're only accruing about a third of the patients that they're accruing. So colon cancer participation in adjuvant trials is pretty poor, which makes us, I think, do more conservative studies, because we realize we've only got so many shots at this, sort of one at a time, two at a time at most.
As you know, this colon project, we sort of patterned it after this classic study that was done in breast cancer that people have been quoting for the last 20 years, where they asked these women who'd had adjuvant chemo, what would it take to go through it again? Half of them said 50%. We sort of did the same thing in colon cancer, and we kind of saw something pretty similar, a significant number of people saying they would go through chemo again. No difference in men versus women. But what do you think is really going on when a patient, whether it's a person with colon cancer or breast cancer, is looking at an absolute benefit of, you know, a couple of percent? Are those really rational decisions, or you know, maybe based on just paralyzing fear?
I think the latter has a lot to do with it. You're totally afraid, and the doctor that you're looking at is maybe giving you pretty frank details about what are the chances are you going to be alive 5 years from now. And there's also somewhat of a societal expectation that chemotherapy is part of cancer therapy. And so, you know, after your surgery and the like, to come back to work and say, "Doc says I should get chemo," that's not unusual now. It's pretty normal. And surgeons, frankly, right after you have your surgery, they say, "I'm going to send you to the medical oncologist." So it seems like a part of the natural flow, and you're scared to death. But that doesn't mean, even in a very calm moment, that you wouldn't do the same thing. I mean, what's the odds that my house is going to burn down? Okay. But I actually pay money on an annual basis in case that happens. And the odds are less than 3% that that's going to happen. But I'm voting with my checkbook to protect that. It's buying insurance. Some people insure more than others. If I'm living on top of a mountain, I don't need flood insurance, right? Or hurricane insurance. But if I'm living on the beach, you know, there's other stuff. You know, so you make informed decisions based on where you are in life and what you're willing to risk. I'll go a different angle, though. Would people make a different choice if they had to pay for it themselves? Not just the side effects. So what if it really costs the same amount of money as it does now, but you had to write the check? I have a feeling that there would be a lot fewer people paying the check for that small benefit. I have a recent example. It's what made me think of it. I have a relatively well-to-do patient who, at the turn of the year, had made a mistake on his health insurance deal and is actually 63, so not quite eligible for Medicare, who was at cycle 9 and realized that a FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting for stage 3 disease, and realized he was paying cash all of a sudden. And so he sits me down January 4 and says, "Doc, you know, what do you think the value of the next 4 cycles are?" And I said, "Honestly, not much." I said, "At this point, I think you've probably had most of the benefits you're going to get." He goes, "Well, I'm paying cash now." I said, "Do you know how much it costs?" He goes, "Yeah, I've already gotten the first bill." And while he can't afford to write those checks, so he's not poor, he could write the next 2 months worth of chemotherapy. After this discussion, he said, "Look, Doc, you're telling me it won't add that much at this point, you know, a percent or two, maybe more?" And I had no idea how to answer that question. It was just a guess. He said, "No, I'm done." So, you know, there are a lot of forces in play that get us to do these kinds of things for small benefit.
One of the things I found interesting, too, is to talk to physicians who get diagnosed with cancer. There's a female oncologist who I interviewed for our breast series who actually got trastuzumab-induced cardiomyopathy, and she got treated before it was even proven and said, I absolutely don't regret taking trastuzumab. She was on oxygen, but still, and she said, now I understand what these people are telling me.
I don't think one can remove the fear factor, if we can say that. I mean, it's unnatural not to be afraid, and a lot of our therapies are, I think, a result of that, of responding to a patient's fear.
Another thing that we saw in this study that I thought was really interesting, and actually a number of the patients that we had interviewed for the audio program that we gave out actually told this story of being told in their oncology office, okay, you're going to get a fluoropyrimidine maybe a few years ago, or more recently, you know, FOLFOX. You're not likely to have hair loss or nausea, vomiting with this chemotherapy, with the supportive medicines we have. And yet Aunt Nellie, who'd gotten, quote, chemotherapy, or other people they may have met or talked to, told them that this is what's going to happen. And actually, more than half of these people went into chemotherapy expecting to have severe nausea, vomiting, and hair loss, and were surprised that it didn't happen. Do you think that that's as common as what we found, and what do you think's going on?
It absolutely is common. I mean, people, their experience, family, friends with chemotherapy is almost always a bad one. Even modern chemotherapy can be rough on some patients, and even though supportive care has gotten significantly better. So they go in with that expectation and then often are delighted. We also have patients that, despite optimum supportive care, have a pretty miserable 6 months. Lots of fatigue, still get the GI stuff, you still get, you know, a crummy week with FOLFOX with a lot of patients. And I do think, as oncologists, we underestimate what people are going through. Again, I'm learning that on a personal level quite a bit, that even grade one toxicity influences somebody at home. It changes how they live their lives a bit. And yes, we're better, but maybe we're kind of used to, when we train, we have to admit patients. When I was a fellow, there was the cisplatin floor, you know, where everybody's, we basically put them to sleep for a week so that they could get through their cisplatin. And so what we see now is so much better than that, that our perspective is, ah, it's a piece of cake. Well, we still have some ways to go, I think. We need to demonstrate to our patients that we're focused on that. If there is a piece of advice I would give to a practicing oncologist at this point is, you know, we rely a lot on our nurses to manage symptoms, and I don't think our nurses are as good at it as we are. They're not as creative at incorporating other medicines to diminish nausea and fatigue and the like. So I do think we all ought to take a more active role in managing our patients' symptoms.
You mentioned a couple of times you've alluded to your personal experience. Do you want to talk about it?
I don't know if it's useful to you.
I think it would be.
So, and I don't think she'll mind. And everybody knows anyway. So after all of the years that I have been publicly jealous and bad-mouthing breast cancer, it pays me back by visiting my house. So my wife was recently diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. So we've gotten to experience all the things we've talked about, the fear, the decision-making around treatments. I mean, she ended up going on to a clinical trial, the management of side effects. She had mucositis. She's lost her hair. She looks very cute, but she's lost her hair. Fatigue, what that means, you know, the picking up the kids at school and all the things that we have to do is, you know, a lot more complicated now that she's going through this. So I'm living it from that side. And I have to tell you, it's made me a born-again symptom management guy, that even a little bit of mucositis that my wife had on cycle one was enough for her to, you know, she chews ice, I promise you, during her treatment and all the things she can do to try and prevent it. I would have 2 months ago said a little bit of mouth sores, you know, didn't prevent you from eating much. You're good. You know, it'll let it be. But it's really changed me in that way. But what's fascinating to me is that, you know, I've run a major cancer center and I had access to everything, instant access to everything. And we continue to be taken care of like we're kings and queens. I worry about that patient who doesn't have that access. And I've been struggling with, well, maybe they don't worry as much because they don't know as much. We know very well what could happen and the like and how to fix it and have ready access to our doctors and the like. But you think about slightly less educated, slightly less connected person who's trying to navigate this process. And, you know, the decision-making was hard enough for us, and we live it every day. There's no way we're doing a good enough job of informing patients that want to be informed, as you point out. So it's had a dramatic influence on me and my practice of medicine, even just in the last couple of months.
Can you talk a little bit how this experience has changed your perspective and your wife's perspective?
I think we were pretty much trying to live every day as we could. I mean, being a cancer doctor makes you appreciate every day. It really does. So it's made me impatient to be a better doctor, to be a better dad, to be all the things that you want to be, because you never know when the rug gets pulled out. And clearly, this has focused us even more on that. The number of people that have come to our aid. I mean, our freezer's full. I got rides for the kids anywhere. The people from work, the people from church, the people from school who come out to help you. The old, it takes a village. Well, it takes a village to, you know, get through something like this. And as oncologists, you know, we're only seeing the two people who show up in the exam room. You know, sometimes the one person. And what we don't realize is the pyramid of infrastructure that it took to get that patient through that cycle and get them in to the next cycle, you know, and get them delivered on time with counts and all of that. We don't get the ripple effect. The ripple effect of telling people bad news. I'm pretty good at telling people bad news. We all are as oncologists. It's sort of a trait we share. But if we felt the ripple of every piece of bad news we gave and took it home, we'd go crazy. Particularly right after my wife's diagnosis, every time it was a bad CT or every time the biopsy was positive, I was feeling the ripple. And it was really a striking thing for me.
Talking about in your other patients.
Yeah. So I'm telling Mrs. Jones that she's got something going on. And, you know, I see in her eyes what I felt in my own heart just, you know, a week or two earlier. And before, that was less powerful for me. You know, I knew what I was doing, but I didn't feel the magnitude of what their dinner table discussion was going to be like that night. So having lived it once, it's really sharpened that feeling. And I hope, I can't maintain that sort of intimacy, you know, 20 times a day. But hopefully it will make me even better at being sensitive to, you know, making sure they get all the information they need for that dinner table conversation.
Do you think this is going to make you more effective as a physician?
I didn't know at first. So far, I think so. So far, I've actually, my clinic slowed down. I'm taking more time. And I didn't know if clinic was going to be something I was going to have to get away from the clinic. And actually, right now, I'm quite drawn to it. And the chances to make that patient's experience as good as it can make it through a rough time.
So you're more aware of your importance.
Yeah, absolutely. Every word that, you know, having hung on the words of, frankly, one of my colleagues, as they talk about side effects and treatment and the like, you realize just how important those words are.
You know, it's a fundamental issue about how close we can get to our patients and not lose our minds, so to speak. Do you think that maybe we've used as an excuse sort of to keep separate from the patients emotionally?
Yeah, I think it's a necessary thing. I really do. I think there has to be some distance. As an example, we had a choice between very good breast physicians at my hospital at Georgetown, Lombardi, one of whom happens to be one of my best friends. And, you know, our families go out and do things. Of course, we immediately went to her, but then we realized that she couldn't really be the objective physician we need. And so while I'm also very good friends with this other one, that made more sense for us. And we're much more comfortable going and hearing and doing the facts with that doctor and then being friends with this other one and if we need advice. So I think it's important, honestly, to ensure objectivity. It's one of the challenges, and we've talked about this before, in colon cancer, GI cancers in general. I mean, we're having to get to know our patients. We get to know their kids. We know them now for 2, 3, 4 years. And we know we're going to watch them die, but we know them. And frankly, I've enjoyed that. But at the same time, when they die, it's a lot harder than it used to be.
How have your children gotten involved with this? What have you been saying to your children? What's happening?
Well, our kids are a little odd in the fact, you know, as any oncologist's kids would be, they know what's going on. I mean, my kids have gone on rounds. They know what cancer can do and what it looks like.
How old are they?
10 and 14. So they're pretty savvy about the whole thing, and I've been so pleased with them. They've, on the one hand, sort of recognized what we're all going through, but on the other hand, they're still bad children. So that means everything's normal. I mean, their rooms are still messy, and they still need fussing after. So they're not walking around on eggshells. We're pretty open about everything. They know what's going on. Not gory details, but they know what's going on. And they're going on with their lives, and that's what we want, frankly. So pretty well-informed kids. We're lucky we haven't seen anything really come out of all this.
Now, you mentioned that the decision was made to enter a clinical trial, and you mentioned that it was the SWOG study that's looking at two different forms of sort of dosage, metronomic, AC, Taxol, growth factors, you know, major therapy here. What led you to enter that study, you and your wife?
So a bunch of things. I think one was what I do for a living. I mean, I'm a major advocate for clinical research, and so the trial was presented to us. And so I think my wife threw that bone to me. Basically, what we were offered is standard dose dents, AC followed by T, 8 cycles versus this trial. Scientifically, again, this is me, not my wife, I was attracted to the whole concept of the metronomic therapy, and she has a relatively aggressive tumor. And so the idea of having extra chemotherapy, said from the guy who wasn't going to get a drop of it, seemed like a good idea. Each of the arms seemed okay to me. So for all of those reasons, not knowing what was the right thing to do, feeling that we needed to do more than just regular dose dents, because we were scared. I mean, here's where the fear comes in. You know, a tumor that sort of grew up overnight with positive nodes. My wife was watched very closely for this. You know, she had a mammogram 3 months before that was negative. So there was the fear factor of wanting to do more, being more aggressive than standard. So for all of those reasons, from my perspective, that trial attracted me. I have to say, after the second cycle of AC, my wife looked at me and said, and I've got to do 4 more of these, why? You know, instead of 2 more, which was standard. So our fear has diminished now, and hopefully it's going to stay down, but we've kind of settled into the we're doing something about it now kind of phase of the treatment and just getting through it.
What's been going on between you and your wife emotionally in your relationship?
We like each other more. This has really turned into a therapy session. Actually, it's been quite good. I mean, we were both very, very busy people. My wife, you know how busy we are, you know, as docs on the road and clinic and all of that. And she's been very involved in my kids' school, on the board of my kids' school. She and I teach Sunday school every Sunday morning. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we're involved with our kids and in life and in the community. So in a sense, for ourselves, we were running in two very busy parallel paths, taking care of our kids and loving each other. But frankly, we're involved in society and the world. I mean, we are both think we're changing the world, and we're there supporting each other as we do it. So there wasn't any marital problem or anything, but we were sort of running parallel instead of together. And in a lot of ways, this has pushed, you know, we've been married a long time, but it's pushed us back together. This is a joint activity. So it's allowed me to refocus in a sense of what's important locally, too.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but a couple of years ago, we did a roundtable on prostate cancer, which was, we had about a dozen medical oncologists, urologists, and radiation oncologists who were diagnosed with prostate cancer in the room for a day. Mm-hmm. It was pretty interesting.
You know, these
urologists who said, oh, you know, I tell these people all the time, this guy had, you know, Gleason 6, completely tiny little focus of tumor. And he wouldn't buy clothes for a year because he was sure he was going to die. And I guess you can relate to that a lot more now.
Absolutely. Just the vulnerability, the suddenness, the unpredictableness. Frankly, it only drives me harder that we should all be impatient. We should all push the envelope. And you've heard me, and I feel this very strongly, every time I give somebody what we call today's standard of care, I feel like I'm giving in a little. I mean, name me a therapy in any cancer where we're done.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think people are upset enough.
They're not.
I mean, you know, there's just this sort of inertia out there. There's inertia in the researchers. You talk about
patients.
Advocacy groups. I don't hear that much from advocacy groups.
They should be furious.
Right. I mean, you know, it's...
How many people die of cancer every year in the United States? And yet, you know, why aren't they camped out on Capitol Hill? Why is the NIH budget, you know, why is the pay line 10%? Why are regulatory rules so tight that it takes forever to get drugs through? Why... All the infrastructure is complacent. And in some ways, I understand that doctors are making a pretty good living and pharmaceutical companies are making a pretty good living, and you and I are too, on the current establishment. And we're proud of our progress. But come on, we're miles from where we need to be. Let's even talk about platinum-based therapy for testicular cancer. Sure, we cure most of those people, but it's a miserable, you know, there's got to be some way we can improve that even. So I, you know, just in some way we have to solve this issue of complacency. I believe it's consumer-driven. It will have to be consumer-driven, that patients will have to rise up. It's like the AIDS groups did. There just isn't enough of that.